Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
G'day listeners, welcome to LNL. In the 60s, Bruce Beresford went off to London in a sort of holy or unholy trinity with Clive James and Barry Humphries, his lifelong friends, and pretty much ever since then, he's been making movies. I haven't seen much of Bruce in the last 20 years or so, but although when he heard rumours of my death, he did come around to check it out. I hope he was not disappointed that I survived. He's now published excerpts from his diary as a filmmaker. We're going to talk about it at some length, but first, Bruce, I want to put this in a context. Millions of books on the film industry by critics, millions by academics, by semioticians and postmodernists, lots of self-serving biographies by actors, but beyond that, it's pretty thin pickings, isn't it?
Yes, I don't know quite why. There are very few really interesting film autobiographies written. I mean, I've made a point of collecting all those written by directors. And I think the only ones that really, really truthful are the ones by Kurosawa and Louis Buñuel. They tell you something exciting. The others are like flim-flam. They're sort of the sort of things put out by press offices.
There's a couple of reasonably good books on the process. There was Lillian Ross's book on the making of The Red Badge of Courage.
Yeah.
There was that enormous volume of the Mimos of Selznick on...
That's quite interesting.
Gone with the Wind,
yep,
principally. And I'm starting to scratch my head.
There's not a lot else.
Oh, screenwriters do kiss and tells occasionally, don't they?
Yes,
you'll never work in this town again.
Disgruntled screenwriters who felt they weren't going to get any more work in Hollywood anyway, so they might as well spill the beans.
Is this one of your motives?
I said the wrong thing there. Well, you know, that really...
It is a bit reckless in part, isn't it?
Yes, maybe it is. That never really occurred to me. See, it really is just my diary, and all I've ever done is add a few footnotes and things to make it a bit clearer. But I guess when I sent it off to a publisher, because I thought people might be interested in what a film director goes through between, actually, two movies. So it starts at the end of one movie.
It's pre and post-coital in that sense, isn't it?
Yes, it starts at the end of one movie. And it stops at the beginning of another, but
maybe
it's a little too frank. I think I've been a little bit surprised at everyone being so astonished by some of the things in it.
In my very cordial review, I make the point that your first feature, Barry McKenzie, tells the story of an innocent abroad, this young Australian sort of caught up in the madness of Britain. And then, you know, it's a fairly obvious point to make that here's another story of an innocent abroad, because you maintain at least a faux innocence throughout the diary. Everyone else is nuts. Actors are nuts. Actors' agents are nuts. Your agents are nuts. Producers are clearly nuts. Financiers are nuts. In short, they're all nuts except you.
I can see why you say that. But, I mean, anyone writing any book or anyone writing any autobiography is always going to paint themselves as a sort of the rather solid centre of it all, and everyone else around them is behaving strangely.
It's just an observation.
What
you're describing
right.
is such a horrendous life. It's so bloody difficult that I would have thought the maddest category of all has to be the director. Why the hell do they keep bashing their heads against every wall to get another project out?
Well, because they love making films. I certainly love making films. And I think people are always saying to me, you know, why do you work on so many projects at once? Well, the reason I've made like 26 or 27 feature films is because I have developed so many at the same time in the hope that one out of 10 might actually find finance.
It wouldn't be much different, say, for Fred Skepsy, would it?
I don't think it would.
Project.
Two directors have rung me and said, my experiences are exactly the same as yours.
When did you start the diary?
Well, I started it about 8 years ago, I think, because I
God for that.
Yes, so you're not. You won't be in it at all.
Even the enlarged edition, I'll escape.
I had to keep track. I started it because I was trying to keep track of all the projects that were coming to me and my original comments, because sometimes someone would ring me and say, what did you think of my script? And I'd have no recollection of it whatever, because I'd have read so many.
So it was a functioning document. It was there as a like a receipt book.
It's a mnemonic, yes.
Who were the directors that rang to say, that's me too?
I don't think I should say it on air. Well, one of them, one was my brother-in-law, John Digan,
yes,
who's made a lot of very good films, and he said, oh, I've been through all that, it's been worse.
Yeah, okay. Bruce, let's tell the story. Let's tell the story before the diary start, your Samuel Pepys peep into the picture business. Let's go back to where and when you happened. Tell us about the family.
Well, oh, Philip, I mean, that's...
I know a few of this, but tell us yeah. anyway.
Well, my parents were very... So my father had a series of mental breakdowns and was emotionally disturbed his whole life, and he ended up having a lobotomy, which is, you probably know, almost the same as a lobotomy. And he was in and out of mental hospitals and was a psychiatrist for his entire life, which threw really the workload onto my mother, who had to work in a series of shops. At one stage, she was a cleaner in a hospital. And, you know, we grew up, there was never a lot of money around. We lived in a housing commission house in Toongabie.
How did you get to university with that sort of financial background?
Well, you only had to get to university, you only had to really pass the exams.
But what about paying for it?
Well,
this is pre-Whitlam.
I got a teacher's college scholarship, which paid for the university course. And then once you've graduated, you pay it back over a series of years, which I did do.
I can remember every Saturday getting a bob from my grandfather, a farmer with whom I lived, and I'd catch the tram from the outskirts of Melbourne to one of the cinemas. I used to like the Rialto at Kew, which was a Hoyt cinema, and you'd see Sam Katzman serials and, you know, all that sort of tribe. And it was magic. But it never occurred to any of us sitting in those cinemas with that flexing shafts of light from the bio box to the screen that any of those things could be made by Australians, apart from the newsreel, you know, when the kangaroo jumped
sure.
into the...
Yeah.
When did it occur to you that it might be remotely possible that an Australian could make a film instead of just being a part of an audience?
I think that I knew that I wanted to make films. I knew that I wanted to be a director certainly before I was 8 years old, and maybe nearer six. I mean, I was fanatical about films, and my parents didn't like me seeing them. My mother, I think, only ever saw about half a dozen films in her entire life.
What was the problem with your mother? Was it religious? Or?
She had a rather snobbish attitude. She thought that servants were the people who went to movies. Not that we ever had any servants, but she thought they were sort of something for the lower orders.
So you would have been.
She was, in fact, a member.
You would have been like me. You would have gone to the matinees.
It was a struggle to get to films. I remember we had tremendous rows, and they finally agreed when I was about, I don't know, maybe nine or something, that I could go once a month. And then I worked for a long time to whittle this down to once a week when the programs changed. They didn't like going. My father used to like films if Errol Flynn or Ronald Colman were in them. Otherwise, he didn't care for them.
Most of the people listening to this chat cannot remember the world we're describing, where there was a choice of Hoyts and Greater Union. Usually there, you know, there's two.
And a lot of cinemas around.
A lot of cinemas, but you tended to go once a week, irrespective of the film, and you almost had your own seats, like going to church.
Well, I used to... See, growing up west of Parramatta, there were a number of cinemas within reach. There was some out at Penrith, there was some in Blacktown, there was one in Seven Hills, one in Toongabie, Wentworthville, three in Parramatta, three in Granville. Mm. They were all over the place. And I used to carefully study all the advertisements in the Daily Telegraph, and I'd find movies that I really wanted to see, and I'd work out how to get to all these places.
What films did you really want to see?
Well, I wasn't that... See, you mentioned the kids' matinees and the Sam Katzmans. I never much cared for those. I think I always much preferred the rather more mature films. I remember going out with friends, and they'd all go off to the Saturday matinee where they ran usually a Western and three serials, and I'd go to one of the
Tom
other
and,
cinemas.
Tom and Jerry.
Yeah,
and...
I'd go to one of the other cinemas where they're running double bills of serious, well, more serious films.
We've even got to describe what a double bill is, the fact that there were
two movies together.
With the Val Morgan slides in the middle. And the B features now probably have got a lot more interest, academic, scholarly, cinematic
interest.
There's
whole books about those films now. I remember some of those B features made a big impact on me. I remember going to the Astra in Parramatta, and on the lower half of a double bill was a B film called The Sun Shines Bright, directed by John Ford. Now, no one's ever heard
of it. You're kidding.
This film was a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still think so. I've now got it on DVD. I think it's a great film.
That's one of the lovely things in the diaries. You go around all over the world. You go into sort of street markets and you buy contraband, pirate DVDs.
Of my own films.
Including your own. I think I've sorted that out now, Bruce. All the ones we did, as you know, have now been lovingly restored and are now
Getting of Wisdom is now out on a beautiful DVD.
As is Don's Party, of course, Bazza. But you actually do find your own movies, do you?
Well, that's the only way to get them. Because, see, when you do a film for a studio, they usually have in the contract that they'll send you one DVD.
Yes.
But then you just try and get it. You'll find it never really shows up. It doesn't really seem to be anyone, it's no one's responsibility.
I've got a new book out, and I get two from the publishers, which is pretty nice of them.
Well, I've just been ordering a stack of my own most recent films off Amazon.
But you don't have any scruples about this, the fact that most of these are absolutely illegal.
Well, that's in China. When I was in China, I found a lot of them.
What about Bulgaria, where I seem to remember you were recently?
Oh, Bulgaria had a. I don't know if they had my films there. They had a lot of bootleg films, yes.
But one of the... We're getting out of sequence here, but one of the things I really like here is you have a generosity of spirit. You're very tough on most categories of people working in the industry, but you're very warm-hearted about films. And there's a couple of Australian films here. You eulogise, and you find the odd film. There was one on the painter, Modigliani.
Oh, the one on Modigliani never got released.
Never got released.
That was a film I found in Bulgaria, in a market. And I thought, a film on Modigliani? That sounds interesting.
Yes.
And I looked at it. It is, in fact, very, very good. It never came out.
But this is something else that people don't realise. It wasn't just during the horrendous years of 10BA in Australia when accountants were having films made to launder money. It's a truth that a huge percentage now of films don't ever hit the big screen.
That's true.
They go straight to the DVD market.
They do. A huge number. I mean, it's staggering. I mean, maybe half of all the films made.
Okay, you go along, you see films you like, you discover a John Ford film on the flip side of a double bill.
Lower half of a double bill at the
Astro. What happens next?
Well, those films, films like that really inspired me. I always wanted to direct films, and I remember saying to my father, you know, how do you actually get to make films? And he thought they were made somewhere at the back of the cinema. He thought there was something went on behind the screen. I mean, he was a simple soul. And I remember going to the Toongabby cinema. I worked out how to get to the back. And I went down the side and I got up behind the screen. Of course, there was nothing there.
So when you discovered this appalling truth that they were made elsewhere.
I realised he was wrong. And I thought, I'm not going to ask him again. And then I started doing... By then I was about 10 or so and I could find out for myself how these things were done. And I started buying little books on how to make films. And then the key thing was that I got an 8mm camera when I was 11 or 12, and I started making films on 8mm, which is... that's disappeared too.
The first film of yours, which I sort of dimly recall, was about, how shall I describe this, fecal material falling from the heavens.
That was a thing done for the University Review.
That's okay.
You
can confess. Is it one of the 27 films you've
done? No, it's not. That was a very short film done
for... It droppeth like the gentle rain.
Yes, it was done for some stage thing.
I think it was the precursor to the Peter Weir film, Last Wave, where you remember all this black stuff kept falling from the sky.
I influenced Peter there.
And then, of course, I became aware of your work when you were making films in Nigeria. Before we'd met, I saw a couple and I thought they were bloody good. But I'd never seen anyone use a particular editing trick, and it was an athlete jumping over.
Oh, you saw that one?
Yeah.
Film for guitar.
And what you kept doing was cutting at the top of the jump.
Yes,
bang,
I kept
bang,
the
bang,
moving.
Bang,
yeah.
Together. And this was pretty cheeky editing. And I remember thinking,
it was
God,
in
this
those
bloke's
days.
Clever.
Yeah, it was in those days.
And so that's what you were doing. You were an itinerant documentary maker.
Well, I was in Nigeria for about 2 years, because when I left Australia at the end of 62 to England, I found I couldn't work in England in films because of this was my aim, because of the union thing there, which they ran a closed shop. You couldn't get in.
Hence Nigeria.
Yes, I went to Nigeria because there was a job advertised there as a film editor, and I found out later I was the only applicant.
And you still got it.
Still got it, yes.
I then asked you to come to Australia to help out when we were setting up the Australia Council, and this, we wanted someone with international expertise, and you'd worked at the British Film Institute.
Yes, well, I was there for 5 years in really what was a very good job, running a thing called the Production Board, and we put up money, very modest amounts of money, for people who were getting their start in films. It was a great setup.
It was like our experimental film fund, which I set here.
Well, it was. I mean, especially great in England, because the unions meant that all those people who would have gone into the film industry under a normal sort of course of events couldn't do it. But they could get money from the production board.
Who came out of that cycle?
Give me a lot of people. Well, Stephen Frears made his first film there. Mike Lee did. Ridley Scott, Tony Scott, Ken Russell. A lot of people. And a lot of people who have become famous as cameramen, editors, designers, through the whole industry.
We're going to skip the next few years, the years in which you and I did a few things together, because I'd rather pass over that and get on onto more recent things.
Remember, you did, in a way, help my career enormously when you offered me Don's Party to direct. Because after the Barry,
that still looks pretty good.
It does look good. See, after the Barry McKenzie films, I was kind of persona non grata. Because the films, they seem to offend so many people who wrote about films. And I was back in England, where I remember you called me and said, would I be interested in directing Don's Party, which I'd never seen or even read.
Is that right? I'd forgotten that.
I'd never. You sent it over, and I couldn't agree. I thought, this is the best play I've ever read. I couldn't agree quickly enough.
You remember that we thought about resetting it. Moving it up in 10 years, and we fiddled with it. That didn't work. But I think your great idea was to shoot it in sequence in a real house. So you put all those actors in that place, and for good and ill, it intensified relationships, didn't it?
It did.
There was all sorts of trouble.
It worked well, and it does, I think, stand up quite well, that film.
After The Getting of Wisdom, you then disappeared. You went off to America.
Not after The Getting of Wisdom, after Breaker Morant.
Sorry, I'd forgotten The Breaker.
Yes, there was a couple more films. And after Breaker Morant, I had a lot of offers from America. And the one I most liked was the script of Tender Mercies, and I went off and did that.
How did you get that job? I mean, I talk about cultural hybridisation. Of course, Hollywood's always done it. If there's a talented director in Germany or Eisenstein on the steps of Russia, they'll bring him over and give him a crack. But a film as culturally specific as Tender Mercies, directed by an Australian.
I know, it was odd. Well, the people who were producing it had seen Breaker Morant, which was not a success in America. But luckily for me, it was shown on the plane between Los Angeles and New York and then back again, and just about every producer saw it. And then a couple who did see it sent me the script of Tender Mercies.
I can remember a couple of times in your career when a film you've made wins every bloody award in the book, but you are denied. Now, that happened with Don's Party. It won, I think, 8 AFI awards, but you didn't get Best Director.
No, I did, Philip.
Did you?
I got Best Director. It didn't get best
Pick, film.
Best film.
That's right.
It won everything else.
But
the reverse of.
My heart went out to you after Tender Mercies. Here's an Oscar-winning film.
Well, I did get nominated as Best Director for that.
Does that help?
It does. I mean, it sort of builds up your credibility somewhat. I think then people will send me lots of scripts they haven't got the money for.
Once you'd established yourself there, and of course you top your performance by making another Oscar winner in Driving Miss Daisy, I can remember being absolutely shocked by something you told me. You told me you'd turn back a Star Wars episode.
They did approach me about the Star Wars film. I mean, it never really went very far. But
You told me you didn't want to do it because you didn't want to direct actors against blue screens.
No, I don't.
You didn't
like
think
that
much of the dialogue. pretty astute.
Well, you know what? I've never been particularly interested in science fiction. You know, the minute they're all dressed up in funny clothes and they're
you love funny clothes.
I have an aversion to films where there's lots of screens with blinking lights.
Yes.
Looks a bit like the studio, but I don't like that.
But you've made lots of films with people in funny costumes and almost out of funny costumes, like King David with Richard Gere.
You weren't going to mention King David, no.
No, we'd pass on. But then there was one I thought was terrific, and that was Black Robe, another film with funny costumes.
I think Black Robe's the best film I've done. It was a very tremendously powerful novel. And I read the novel and got an option on it almost straight away. And I think the film, you really feel that you're back there in Canada in 1629. I thought it had a tremendous authenticity about it.
It's not the first time you'd tackled an Indigenous subject, because you made a really good film on called The Fringe Dwellers.
Oh, The Fringe Dwellers.
Do you remember opening night in Cannes? Will you ever forget that? Or was it one of your openings you refused to attend? That's one of your quirks.
I wasn't in Cannes. Because I was shooting another movie and I couldn't go.
Incidentally, I'd better identify you. This is Bruce Beresford, film director, and this is a little wireless program called LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. Okay, I was in Cannes. I wasn't representing you. I was running the AFC at the time. And all your actors were there.
All your
Aboriginal actors in The Fringe Dwellers were there. And this was fantastic for them. But there was also a protest group of Indigenous people from Australia.
Oh.
Also got there with government money, who were actually attacking the film. It was a very tense and difficult night.
What were they attacking?
They thought that they were accusing the actors, incidentally, virtually of Uncle Tomism and being in it.
Well, that seems very unreasonable.
And the film
they were just jealous they didn't get roles.
Yeah, anyway, it came rushing back when your leading lady died a few weeks ago.
And the leading Bob Mazza, poor old Bob Mazza, died a few years ago. Great guy.
Mm. When I was trying to review this for a paper, I was asking myself what people who watch your career often ask, and I don't know whether you ever ask it, what are the connections? You know, usually a director hacks out a piece of turf, a piece of territory, like a painter, so you can see them a mile off. Yeah. You know that that's Buñuel, you know, that's Bergman, you know, Woody Allen, for God's sake. Whereas your films seem to have nothing in common, except that you like telling stories.
Well, I think you've answered the question. That is it. I find that any one film I do is so completely absorbing, like for about maybe a year and a half. And you just sort of, all you do is work on that film day in, day out. And it's all you ever think about, research it until you know the subject off backwards. And then when it's finished, I like to do something that has got no connection with that story.
To clear the palate,
yes.
In effect.
And I find it sort of reinvigorates me to go into something which is completely different.
Before we talk about the fact that you've had to juggle half a dozen films in this book with quite bitter consequences, I think, let's remind the listener that the filmmaking process is bloody long. There's a couple of years of planning, of trying to get a script, the money together, the pre-production, so-called. There's the production. And then there's post-production, which can last quite a while.
It would be hard for any... From the moment you get the word go on the pre-production till the time the film is actually ready to be screened would be 12 to 15 months at the quickest.
Mm. Which brings us to the journal. Because here's this guy. He's got great track record. He's made a couple of lemons, so has everybody. But he's, God help us, he's made some zingers. Oscars abound. And here you are. Desperately trying, and I use the plate juggling metaphor. You're like one of those conjurers who've got the bowl spinning on the bamboo stems.
Yeah, get the picture, yeah.
Up and down. This is for the listener. And there's a bowl at that end wobbles. You rush down and give it a twirl to keep it going. And that's what you do in this book, isn't it?
Yes, because it's just not that easy to set up films. There's so many variables. See, if it was simply a matter of me saying, I want to do this film on this subject and let's grab those actors and give me some money, that'd be great. But it's never like that because usually now the money's coming in from half a dozen different sources. You've got to take all those things into account. You've got to do legal agreements with people putting money in from, say, five different countries.
Well, it's not really your job. It's the job of the producer. And most of the producers that you describe and frequently name don't do it.
They try to do it. I think they're well-intentioned. I mean, they're likely to say almost anything to me. It's very common for them to say to me, look, Bruce, we know you like the script. We have got the money. It's all set. We've just got a couple of very minor things to sort out. But we've got the money, really.
And 2 years later, they're
and that's usually
saying.
That's usually not true. They want it to be true. In varying degrees. See, some of them, sometimes they pull it off. You know, they can do it. Some of those films in there have actually been done.
The young Bruce Beresford used to have his fingerprints all over the screenplay. Has that been the case throughout your life?
Yes. I mean, I still work on all the scripts. You've really got to work. I mean, a number of the films I've done, I did actually write myself. Not a majority, but some of them. And others, I've worked closely with the writers. I mean,
but
if you
writers are also as eccentric, by your account, as these producers who can't produce. You seem to have writers who can't write.
Well, some of them... See, some of those writers that I've talked about in there, like the American J.D. Zeick, I think is a very good writer. I read some plays that he wrote, and I read a couple of scripts that he wrote that were his own original scripts. But see, then what happens is he's a Hollywood writer for hire. So he's writing scripts in which he's got really no particular investment. He doesn't feel that drawn to the subject.
But that doesn't make his contribution less useful in a
well,
way.
It usually means that if you haven't got their passion, it's very hard to make it work.
I can remember the case of one of the films, and one of our films, which I won't mention, where you kept sending the screenplay back to the writer to make it shorter because it was...
Oh, yes. It kept getting longer.
It kept getting longer.
Well, then... So my stories of the eccentricities of these people are not all that...
No. I'm not denying them. I just found it extraordinary. Writers gave you, in a sense, almost as much trouble as anyone else.
Yes, but they don't all do that. I mean, I've just been working on a script here. I proposed a script to David Williamson about Eric Liddell, the Olympic runner. And he's turned in a first draft in a very short time. And really, it's quite wonderful.
Yeah. Mind you, Dave is an old pal.
But it's still true that it's quite wonderful.
Liddell was the other runner in
Chariots of Fire.
Remember Lord, what's his name, telling me. What's his name? David. What's his name now?
Putnam.
Lord Putnam telling me that he was going to Liddell's house to interview him in the pre-production for the...
But Liddell died in 1940...
No, well, I promise you, this is the story that Putnam tells. He got to the house and they were bringing out the coffin.
Liddell died in 1943. So it must have been the other runner. It must have been the other one.
When did he
Abrahams. It must have been Abrahams.
Have been Abrahams. Yeah. In fact, it was now.
Yeah.
Because one of them was Jewish and one of them was Christian.
That's right.
And I pointed out that David was torn between his two identities.
Liddell was the Christian. Liddell became a missionary in China.
Yeah.
And the script David Williamson has written is about that part of his life.
Getting the money together is often contingent on having an actor. And the worst stories in the book, and every filmmaker I know has the same sort of anecdotes, are about you being tantalised by the possibility, begging someone else, or having someone totally inappropriate foisted upon you.
That's right.
A 6-foot character to play Tiny Tim.
Well, the problem with the actors is that there's about 15, maybe 20 name actors in the whole world. And everyone who's setting up a film from anywhere wants one of those names attached to the movie in order to guarantee their investment.
And it's good that quite a few of them now are Australian.
Maybe half a dozen. This means, though, that those actors are getting every script there is. So it's very hard to get their attention. They're lost. They're deluged with the thing.
But they're not getting the scripts. The scripts aren't actually getting to the actor very often,
well,
are they?
Well, if you know them personally, you can sometimes get them to them. No, they go to agents who then say, well, how much are you going to pay the actor? And you might say, well, we can afford $750,000. And they say, well, they usually get $15 million, get lost.
This is a good time to tell the listener the name of the book. Josh Hartnett definitely wants to do this. True stories from a life in the screen trade. Let's tell the Josh Hartnett story.
Well, Josh, a producer called Peter Cronenberg called me and had a script about the jazz trumpeter Chet Baker. And I said, have you got the finance? And he said, no, but I'll be able to get the finance easily because Josh Hartnett definitely wants to do this. And that was the beginning of a saga. We haven't made that film.
So it hasn't made that happen, but it made the book happen.
It made the book happen, yes. Yeah.
But Josh Hartnett actually did read the screenplay, because you have an encounter with him.
Well, you see, Peter Cronenberg had a screenplay written by his girlfriend, which I didn't think was terribly good. And I wrote a screenplay, a new one. I mean, it took me months and months, and I had to do a lot of research. And I thought, naturally, you won't be surprised to hear me say, I thought my screenplay was good. And certainly I could direct it, I knew that. But then Peter Cronenberg said to me that Josh Hartnett preferred the screenplay by the girlfriend and wanted to make the film, but not if I directed it.
Well, that's one of the terrible, the sad things in this book. Again and again, you invest a couple of years of your life and effort in really pushing a project, writing a screenplay, fiddling with other people's, enduring endless, irritating meetings, flying across the world to try and pick up an extra quid or so. And suddenly you lose the project, or you find yourself contractually obligated to make a film you have no intention of making, and you miss out. Well, for instance, the slavery film, the Wilberforce film.
Oh, the Wilberforce one. Well, yes, that was really unfortunate because I desperately wanted to do that. But my agent insisted that I was obliged to do the Bulgarian film, The Contract, and that if I didn't, I would most likely be sued. Now, I think he really had an agenda of his own there, because he represented some of the actors in that film. And if I didn't do it, the actors wouldn't do it, and I think he could have been in trouble at the agency. I'm only surmising this, but
one of the worst experiences I had in film was when we were doing We of the Never Never, and we had to film a crossing of a flooded river, and there was a drought. There was no river to flood. So what we got was half a dozen motorboats and a dam, you know, off screen, all with their engines running like mad, creating a bit of a ripple in the dam, which we then pretended
was a flood.
That story came to mind because of you and your helicopter. Tell us the that helicopter story.
Well, the producers in Los Angeles wanted me to put a lot of helicopter scenes in the film The Contract, which is a thriller, to be filmed in Bulgaria. They wanted a lot of helicopter scenes in.
Why?
Because they said they had access to helicopters in Bulgaria and it would be exciting on screen. So I found various ways of putting a lot of helicopter stuff in the script. Then when I got to Bulgaria, I found out there were only two helicopters in the whole country. One of them was owned by the president and was a Russian thing. You couldn't use it. And the other one took tourists to the Black Sea. And the one the studio had was made of wood and didn't fly at all.
Did you shoot around it?
Well, it was a nightmare. We had to use the wooden one for some bits, and then we had to digitally put the helicopters in by computer, which was pretty expensive.
We're digitally enhancing Late Night Live with Bruce Beresford. This is LNL, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. The other night I turned on the telly, and to my horror, I saw Nanook of the North being reenacted, this famous documentary where this Inuit was paddling across Sydney Harbour. It turned out to be you. Surely that was a digital effect.
You saw me kayaking on the harbour. I go kayaking, you know, 3 or 4 days a week. I go out early in the morning when there's not too much ferry traffic.
Well, first of all, I couldn't believe it was you, because you're well into your 60s now, aren't you?
Look at me, I'm as
fit as a
man mountain. Yes.
Okay, but I didn't think you could kayak on Sydney Harbour.
You can kayak on Sydney Harbour. I mean, most people who do it go out in the weekends. But see, I go out about 7 in the morning, 7 till 9, something like that.
The reason that you were being filmed kayaking on Sydney Harbour with the Opera House in the background was to promote the fact of your other life. Now, I've got to put this in context. For someone who loves music and knows an enormous amount about it, in fact, you'd be the most musically literate of the Australian directors, you were always very reluctant to use any, to actually put any in the films.
Is that so?
Absolutely. Don't you remember the wrangle over Don's Party, where right at the end, in the last seconds, you put in one of your favourite classical bursts?
Oh, that's it. I used some Janacek. But it was very effective,
too. It was lovely. But this music occurs naturally, of course, in the films. Well, it comes out of radio.
Well, I don't particularly like loading films up with bad music. I'm not so... Which is what a lot of scores are.
They pour syrup on them, don't they?
They're just bombastic, and they sort of... they tell you of every upcoming emotion. emotion and everything. Now there are some terrific composers around. I'm less worried about it.
I was wondering, when you're directing opera, whether you like to cut the music from the opera as
you
well.
You can't do anything in the operas. You have to do them exactly as written. Sometimes you
so you,
you know,
allow all that music to be in your opera productions.
Oh, Philip, I love the music. Of course, when you've got music in an opera, it's wonderful music.
The reason you were kayaking was because you were in rehearsal for a stage play, a very famous stage play, which became an even more famous film, which now, via André Previn, is really a famous opera.
Yes,
Streetcar.
The opera was written only about 10 years ago. I saw it in San Francisco, and then when Opera Australia asked me to direct an opera for them, they asked me to give them a list. This was one of the ones we discussed.
To put this in context, once again, you've been directing operas for how long?
The first one was in 1986, so it's about 20 years or so. I haven't done that many. This is my seventh, I think.
You've done them all over the world, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, I've done them.
For example?
Yeah, I've done, well, mostly in America.
Texas?
One in Italy.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Texas, Portland Opera, Los Angeles. I did one at the Kennedy Center, one in San Diego. One
are, they
in Adelaide.
Are they as important to you as the films?
I love doing them. I mean, it's great. It's very interesting directing operas. Opera to me, it's a tremendously compelling art form. I find it sweeps me away in the way films do, you know, good films do. I get very emotionally caught up in them. And
Bruce, do you have the same control, directorial control, on the stage of the opera house as you do on a film set?
Well, it's different. I mean, obviously I'm not conducting it. And
that must be immensely frustrating.
No, well, I couldn't possibly do that. But we had a wonderful conductor with Streetcar. I mean, what I'm really doing is directing a play. And I'm trying to... I'm talking to the singers, who these days are much more aware that operas have to be acted as well as sung. And I'm telling them, you know, what I think the characters are, what they should be doing, and why they're reacting in certain ways. It is really like directing a play.
There's a new opportunity for you. I was leafing through New Yorker before going on air last week, and there's an extraordinary story about high-definition television recordings of the major operas.
Oh, they're doing that,
which are being released in the shopping mall cinemas, and they're doing as big business as Die Hard 4. There's suddenly a wave of people going to see opera on high-definition projection in shopping mall cinemas.
Well, I've heard about this. I think it's a great move. And in London too, they've been showing operas in the Covent Garden outside the Opera House, and the thousands of people sit there and watch. And I was going through there a few weeks ago, and they were showing Turandot, and the attention of the audience was absolutely amazing.
The report in New Yorker says that the operas are often considerably enhanced by the quality of the direction for these things, but that the singers are now whizzing off to plastic surgeons to be cosmetically enhanced.
Yes, the days of the big fat sopranos and everything, I think, are going to go. I mean, they all look much more suitable for the roles these days.
Well, that comes back to your production of Streetcar, Named Desire, where the lead actor had comparable musculature to Brando.
Oh, Teddy Tahu Rhodes is a 6'5" New Zealand hunk. He's an extremely handsome man with an incredible physique. Could you imagine if you'd cast someone as Stanley Kowalski, who
didn't look as good
didn't
as,
look the role
as good as Brando?
We'd be ridiculed.
But you also made or contributed to a film, I suddenly remember, called Aria.
Oh, yes, I did. I did one. That film was a series of arias, done by a different director. And I did an aria from an opera called The Dead City with Elizabeth Hurley. It was her first film. She was 17 years old and beautiful beyond belief.
That's something else you often say in the journal. You're very susceptible to the beauty of people you see.
Well,
this is a screen director's eye, isn't it?
Yes, I can't help that. I hope I haven't offended anybody. It doesn't seem very offensive to say that you think this person or that person is very beautiful.
I'm not criticising you. I think beauty is a phenomenon, and it's a rare phenomenon, and it is quite astonishing when you are confronted by it, whether it's in a work of art or a human being.
Yes, it's often, I couldn't help commenting.
Okay, now you're one of the directors who didn't sort of just decide to go and live at the casino. You live here, you wander around, you make your films here and there. as do a couple of your distinguished colleagues. But you've seen everything from the Renaissance of the early 70s to right through to now, where we're a backlot for so many, well, Star Wars prequels, for example.
But there's still some very good Australian films.
I'm going to ask you, what state is the Australian film industry in now, in your view?
Well, there's been a lot of really quite low-budget films over the last few years, many of which I thought were very good. I mean, recently I saw Romulus, My Father, which I thought was a really excellent film.
I think it's a lovely film, yeah.
Beautifully directed and a very touching story. It's wonderfully shot.
Mm.
And another one I liked was Somersault, which I went and saw twice. I thought it was so well done.
Tell the listener about it. What is it?
Well, Somersault's a story of a very intense story of a girl who is in a broken home. She kind of nearly has an affair with her mother's boyfriend, and then embarrassed, she goes and gets a job in Jindabyne. And that's the people she meets up with. And there's a parallel with the drowned town and the drowned emotions of the characters.
Jindabyne's been featuring lately, hasn't it?
As
a metaphor for film.
In a number of them, I know. It's been. But I think Somersault was the first.
I noticed with pleasure that one of your daughters is now quite a significant camera person in her own right.
Yes, I
saw her on the telly of the night, and I was just astonished by how, like Rasheen, her mother, she is. I've never seen a kid who looks more like a parent.
She does look astonishingly like a mother, yes, it's true.
So despite having watched her poor old dad flail around juggling projects between movies, she actually wants to make them.
Yes, she does. She kind of crashed around a bit. I mean, she did a degree at Cambridge, and she'd been before that a musician. She was a very good clarinetist. Then she told me she wanted to be a cinematographer. And I was a bit wary at first, but then when I saw some of her photography, I stopped objecting.
It's not only your children who are looking at the film industry, it's in a sense our children. When I go to cinemas and look at a DVD, I'm amazed by how many of the kids that worked for us all those decades ago are now big time.
Yes, a lot of them.
Let's rattle off a few. Don McAlpine, who shot Barry McKenzie.
Who's recently shot in a row three of the biggest films ever made. And
name them, please.
Well, he did Moulin Rouge, he did Peter Pan, and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, one after the other.
Mm.
Massive achievement to have done that. I mean, and his photography is incredible.
Your designer, who had to make an abandoned building in Earl's Court look even more abandoned.
Well, John Stoddart has gone on and done about six more films with me, plus four operas. And he, in fact, designed Streetcar Named Desire.
Gail Tattersall, I saw the other night.
Well, Gail Tattersall was our camera operator, remember? English, who emigrated to Australia. He's now in America. He shot a lot of big movies and big television series.
Why have we done so well at the casino? Why is it that so many Australian cinematographers are now megastars in their own right? Why is it that we've got, say, six out of that roster of the major bankable stars? Why is it that our directors like you and we are doing Truman and other things done so well? What is there? Is it something in the water, or was it good generalised background?
I think a lot of those actors are very well trained. And I know that they have... I know from, people I've worked with in America, they love working with Australian actors because they're probably some exceptions, but they find them agreeable, they turn up, they work hard, and they're very cooperative. They have a very good attitude, a very good work ethic. There may be exceptions to this, but certainly this is a comment that's often made to me.
People got to buy the book. Buy the book, read the exceptions.
It's also true, though, that the technicians here are very, very good.
But Bruce, surely that comes out of the fact that when we were starting up, and when a feature film cost $250,000, and there was this huge wave of enthusiasm to be involved in it, no one was getting any money, and that, there weren't union restrictions, I mean, people just worked their butts off, and they had to do a bit of everything. Surely it's that sort of bush carpentry that helped, or bush mechanical work.
Yes, you're right. I mean, it's the fact that they had to improvise a lot. I know when we were doing Driving Miss Daisy, the budget was cut at the last minute from $17 million to $7 million, which was a massive cut. And then I said to the producer, Richard Zanuck, well, we could we could shoot in a real house and save a lot of money. And he said, oh, you couldn't shoot it in a real house. I mean, cameramen just aren't used to that. And I said, let me bring a cameraman from Australia because they know how to do that.
Yeah.
And I brought over Peter James and never turned a hair, shot the whole film in the real house and looked fantastic.
And not the first time you'd done that.
No, yeah. No, I'd done it with Don's Party.
So that's it, our sort of pioneer spirit is...
Yes, I think they're used to working. They've had good training on a lot of low-budget films, which has taught them a hell of a lot. But there seems to be something, the cameramen have got a great feeling for a sort of natural light. I mean...
The fact we weren't a studio-based industry, that we had to make films on location, which was at the time.
I think that's been beneficial, yes. And I think now, and even when now people do work in studios, they recreate the light of real places.
My heart went out to you as one of the anecdotes from Bulgaria. You were making a film you really didn't want to make. A couple of projects that you were busting to do.
Fell through.
Have got, well, not worse. They've gone on to
others.
Went
to somebody else directed
them. Someone else is doing
them. True.
You wouldn't mind them collapsing.
No.
But, you know, that's terrible.
I must say they were both directed very well by other people.
That's very gracious. But that's not the story. You've almost finished this crazy film you're doing, reluctantly. And... there's no money. You've run out of money and the film isn't completely finished. You paid for the film.
Well, I had no choice. They told me that...
You've got a lot more work now if you put this story out. Well, you will pay for the film.
I'm certainly not going to do it again. But I was sort of back-painted into a corner where I had no choice because they would have just said, oh, well, we'll cut together what we've got, which would have been a shambles, but it would have had my name on as director. Or they'd have brought in some hack director and done a quick job cheaply, and it still would have had my name on as director.
Writers can get their names off films and famously do so. Why can't directors?
Oh, I did inquire about that. I called my lawyer in LA if I could get my name off it, and he said no. He said the contract is absolutely ironclad, you have no chance.
Thank heavens you were making this film in Bulgaria rather than Los Angeles.
Actually, the film is not bad. I mean, it's just a conventional thriller, but it's quite fun. It's well played, Morgan Freeman and John Cusack.
Yes, that was a surprise because you'd heard that Cusack is a real asshole to work with, and he turned out to be...
No, I thought he was great.
Morgan, you knew, of course.
Morgan is a wonderful man. But I'd heard stories about Cusack being very difficult, but he was... he was great. He was wonderful.
Tell us a horror story. I haven't pumped you for this, that sort of gossip. But tell us about someone who was an absolute prick.
Well, you know, it's hard to think of actors who were. The worst actor I ever had to deal with was a man called J.T. Walsh, who is dead. He had a heart attack a few years ago.
Well, we can speak freely.
Yes, we can speak freely. He was one of those strange people who never wanted to do anything the director wanted. You'd say, look, if you walk into the room and stop here, he'd say, I don't want to do that. And he also hated the other actors. So he created a poisonous atmosphere on the set. Well, usually if the actors don't get along, you're in terrible trouble.
Do you remember on Don's Party, we won't name names, but there was one actor who got on very well with Graham and then turned against him. It almost destroyed us.
Yes, that was tricky. We had 11 of them on that. There were some tensions.
Yeah.
That can happen. The thing that often happens to me, I find, is I have to do love scenes with a young couple, and then the girl will come up to me just before we start shooting, and she'll say, I don't have to kiss him, do I? I can't bear him. I say, but this is a big love scene. You're madly in love with him. She said, he can't kiss me. I don't want him to kiss me. That's happened three or four times.
I remember Greta Scacchi making this point at Cannes during those great big, enormous press conferences on a film she'd just made with a very famous actor, and he was sitting on the platform with her, and she was saying exactly the same thing about him through clenched teeth.
What's been going on between these two that's made her so hostile?
What projects are you juggling at the moment in the last minutes we've got together?
Well, I've written a script about the Battle of Long Tan, up in Vietnam, in which about 18 Australians were killed, and I've delivered that, and the producers tell me that they can raise the money for it, but it would be sometime next year.
Marnie, though, The Fortunes of Richard
the
Marnie,
fortunes of
that's the one I want to see.
Well, The Fortunes of Richard Marnie, I did sort of two scripts. I did a four-hour miniseries adaptation. I also did a feature adaptation. But we've only really pushed the miniseries, and no one seems to be interested in it. Whether it's the project or my adaptation, I'm not sure, but it's certainly...
I know it's an incredibly didn't hard go anywhere. Thing to adapt.
It's a tough
but
one to adapt.
But the last part of that novel is phenomenal.
I know, the final third of it is absolutely devastating. It's really wonderful. It's very disappointing to me that we haven't been able to interest anyone in it, but we haven't.
But you can keep poking it,
we can keep
you?
Trying, you can, yeah. Oh, sometimes these things come back and you can do them.
One of the characters in the diary is involved with Marnie. He's a friend of mine, so I said, do you realise you're starring in Beresford's book? And I told him what you said, and he got a completely different version of that, but it's a Rashomon standoff between his view and your view.
Who is this?
Well, I don't want to tell you what I mean. I want to preserve your career, not make it tougher. But you're always reading, aren't you? You're buying books, you're reading them, you're going to plays,
yes.
You're looking, scrounging
well,
for ideas.
Yeah, you know, sort of. Yeah, might as well, while I feel up to it, I'll keep doing as much as I can. I'm supposed to be doing the film now, Mao's Last Dancer, of this...
I've talked to the author. It's a wonderful book.
Yes, it's a wonderful book, and I think that film will go ahead with the producer, Jane Scott, who did Shine.
And she also was production manager on Barry McKenzie. That's right. Way back. So she's another one of
well,
the
Jane,
kids who've done...
When I worked at the BFI production board, Jane was my assistant for 5 years.
I've been talking to Bruce Beresford, and here's great news, ladies and gentlemen. Josh Hartnett definitely wants to do this. True story. He wants to play Richard Marnie? Amazing. True stories from a life in the screen trade. Screen trade, not skin trade. Why did I say that? Who's the publisher, Bruce?
HarperCollins.
HarperCollins. And it's lovely to catch up with Bruce Beresford again after many a long year. Now, I need to take a minute to remind you, or to tell you of what's happening over the next couple of weeks on LNL. From Monday, and for the week, you'll be entranced by the wit and conversational weight of Liz Jackson. Liz is taking a detour down the corridor from Four Corners to sit once again in a Radio National studio, which was her spiritual home. Oh, and the following week, you'll be bamboozled by the Scottish vows of the good Dr. Norman Swan, who's dashing back from Glasgow to make his appointment with the Gladys and the Bodies. Where will I be? In East Timor with Chris Bullock, our executive producer. We're going over to gather material for a series on the people, the politics and the culture of Timor-Leste to be broadcast on LNL in late October, early November. This tiny, struggling nation holds an important place in the hearts and minds of many Australians. It is a deeply proud, culturally rich and very religious country in which everybody has a story to tell, a story of survival. Clearly, we'll be talking to the political leaders about the immense social and economic challenges, but we'll also be taking you into the mountains and the coastal plains to places like Balibo, Same and Vakeke. And you'll get to know a delightful Timorese character. Her name is Sayu, and as well as a guide and interpreter, she's a great storyteller, and she's going to become a very good friend to all of us. There's more, because we'll have a blog. A blog, my first, on which you'll be able to see and hear where we are and what we're doing, satellite coverage permitting. If you go to our website next week, you'll see the links to that blog. Thanks to the team, Kate, Chris, Gail, Paul and Chris. On our next is Classic LNL, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thank you.
listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.